Blog Talk Radio.
Comes the time for love, joy, information, dissemination. That is, here comes the time from Blessed Brother in Arms, Spirit and Soul, Rav Yitzhak Paton, and this is Soul Class number 147, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah. I'm just going to call in my co-hosts and greet them. Good morning, Dennis Ryan, our advocate, teacher, and student of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimonides. And also our Noah Haid Chassid, Ron Williams. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dennis. I'm done.
Okay, gentlemen, you know, I'm in a happy mood. I'll tell you why I'm in a happy mood. First of all, it is a great pleasure to reunite with both of you gentlemen. This bright and sunny, beautiful, sunny, peppered with big, billowy white clouds here in Kessler Crown Heights, Brooklyn, New York. The month of Adar, this is a month where we of the Jewish nation rejoice. We have a wonderful holiday coming up called Purim, which maybe we'll get to next week, or hopefully we'll get to it next week in our discussions. Also, I just want to point out to everyone that in 4 days, as a cause for reflection, the nation of Israel will be celebrating not only the birthday, but the day of the ascension of the mighty soul of the Levite prophet Moses, whose 5 books of Moses, on one level or another, we all are, in fact, studying. So we'll get to that in a moment, but I just want to go into the preview of today's show. Blessed is our Creator. Blessed souls, we're moving on with our series of pointing out to you that we plan to explore now. Book of Genesis, chapter 2, verse 8, quote, "And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed," unquote. So we see, blessed souls, our common ancestor, Adam, or Adam HaRishon, and first man, was put in a garden that was planted eastward. So what do we learn from this verse? Tune in and join the meditation, as what we plan to vibe out on some wisdom from Rabbi Nachman, The Path of the Righteous Gentile, by Rabbis Klorfin and Rogalski, Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition by Rabbi David Sears, Rambam, Chassidus Chabad, and anything that comes down the pipeline when dialogue is live and organic. So before we get to a matter I want to cover, which is basically a wonderful teaching by one of our singers, our performers at the end of our show, David Dome. Dennis, anything you'd like to share with our listening audience who we want to encourage other people to call in at 347-838-8669? Any tidbits you'd like to share with us, reflecting what I just shared with everyone, or if something that you think would be of interest to our listeners?
Well, being happy is not dependent on the sun being out. We must be happy all the time, or try to be happy as much as we can, because that's thinking on a positive basis.
Beautiful. Ron, your take on being happy.
Actually, this happiness is a state of mind. It's not really dependent on external factors. So I think
right.
That's one of the greatest accomplishments we can try to accomplish.
True. I just want to point out, before I go into this article, Being Deep by David Dome, that Rambam, Maimonides, talks about in the laws concerning the festival of Sukkot, that a person who is serving God in joy is having a continual feast. Now, anyone who continually feasts will become grossly obese, but here a person is actually fattened in their delights in serving the Most High, and certainly that won't elevate their cholesterol, blood sugar levels. Actually, it will make them lighter on their feet. It's much easier to serve the Most High out of joy and out of sadness. With that being said now, gentlemen and blessed souls listening out there, I want to turn to an article that I saw earlier this week. It was actually a week ago today, on February 19th, that singer-composer, and actually is a practicing optometrist out in Jolly Old England. Let's raise a cup of tea for our friends out there in England. This is written by David Dome and posted 8:46 a.m. last Sunday. So we started off by saying, Baruch Hashem, which means blessed is the Creator. It's often the case that growing up with a traumatic childhood leads people to become deep thinkers as we try to understand what we went through, who we became as a result, and often we end up being the analyzers of the world. To many, our analysis can seem deep and profound, even verging on wisdom. To others, it looks as though we have made ourselves remote and too deep to understand. We remain an enigma, mysterious even. But however, David continued in saying, being deep is a double-edged sword. It can make you a savior to those who benefit from your advice and experience, having learned all about dealing with emotional turmoil. On the other hand, it makes us resistant to criticism as we hide that part of our inner self that didn't grow up due to being left in the shadow of the quote-unquote chacham, or the wise men we have become, at least in our own eyes. And so, David continued, the chacham, the wise man, becomes a fool. How can we save others when it's us that needs to be saved? Having emunah, faith, helps us to become truly wise. It gets us outside the foggy comfort zone we make for ourselves. In the foggy comfort zone, and then he put in parentheses, which is really a very uncomfortable place to be, end of the parentheses, we can study the concepts of bittul self-nullification and other deep concepts. We can also delve into Kabbalah. Now we'd like to add Hasidus to learn about the journeys of the soul, otherwise known as Shama. Then we can speak of things with others and use this knowledge to categorize what we see in the world. Pretty impressive. All this does, however, is perpetuate the myth we have created for ourselves, and therefore we remain undeveloped. We most need to be developed. We stand apart from others, feeling isolated and misunderstood, with paradoxical responses that superficially promotes the idea of, quote, go away, end quote, but really means, quote, don't leave me alone, unquote, asterisk point. Keeping it simple is the antidote. Simple simplicity. None of us need to be constantly remote from the world. We shouldn't want that unless it's our purpose to be there as a secret tzaddik, a secret righteous person. For example, it's not good for anyone. Better to strip it down to the bone, build up your faith, your emuna, as a base to build on and start all over again. That means there is no longer any past. All there is now, existentially speaking, where the undeveloped part of our inner selves can step out of the shadows and call out to God, laughing, crying, dancing, even still denying and saying, Tati, Father, I want to come home, end of quote. Ron, Dennis, what is your take on this, which I think is a pretty provoking, thought-provoking article?
Well, it is thought-provoking to a certain extent, but we got to be careful about twisting and combining things, because when we are young, we are developing, we are open. And when we are open, we sort of accept everything until we start finding out that maybe it really isn't what we thought it was. So this is called leading into adulthood. But when we become adults, we become a little bit leery and withdrawn, because we learn that you cannot openly trust everybody 100%. There's some people that just don't accept your openness, so you have to treat them in a different way. So as we get older and gain some wisdom, we treat different people on different levels, but we don't mean no harm in doing that. It's just that you have to live and let live. So therefore, we are open to those people who need the help, but we don't assume that everybody needs the help. It's just like a physician. If a physician was standing on the corner of a street and all people walking by, he wouldn't say, every one of these people need my help. Maybe they might, but only those who come and ask for his help would he give it to them. So therefore, what Isaac Dome was talking about here is, yes, we develop when we're young to open analytical ideas, but we're accepting because we're gaining experience. When we get older, we think a little differently because we have to adjust, and those adjustments are trying to keep us sane, happy, and in God's eyes.
True. Dennis, Ron, your comments, questions. What's your take on David Dome's article?
I particularly took interest in the part where he says that, you know, many times we're trying to fix others when we, in truth, we're the ones that need this fixing. The thing is, I found is that many times when we sincerely give advice to others, it's actually the advice that we should be taking. And many times we're approached with certain questions, it's an inner question that we have it stored it in our subconscious because we couldn't quite reason it out. But through trying to assist another person, we find that we're actually answering ourselves. The problem is many times is we don't listen to ourselves. So, and, you know, we don't accept that advice we give out to others for ourselves. So I feel this is a point where, you know, we have to pay a little bit more attention.
True. I think that, Ron, you plucked out a point that I think is so essential to human growth, and I myself am a student of human growth and trying to grow myself as a human being. I didn't stop growing just because I finished my college and high school and preliminary schooling, that listening to ourselves, and then let me extrapolate a little bit, and then as we listen to ourselves, getting feedback from our environment around us, whether the feedback be positive, negative, or somewhere in that gray area between positive and negative, there needs to be introspection. And unfortunately, today I was talking with someone about a certain concept relating to this week's Torah portion, and he was in such a rush, so I found myself having to accelerate the speed by which I was trying to deliver a certain, what I thought was a salient point. And I realized, you know what, I should have waited until tomorrow when both of us are before our prayer services. Perhaps it would have been delivered better. And he liked the idea, but he was in a rush, so it caused me to be in a rush. And, you know, sometimes we have to have timing. And I just want to bring out something that is a very important point brought up by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, is that he advises against other people going around giving other people's advice. However, at the same time, too, if someone comes to you for advice, then you have to, again, be reflective within yourself to ask yourself, you know, if this person's coming to me, or you, Dennis, or Ron, for advice, then it's our responsibility at some level to try to give them advice, which hopefully is for their benefit and not for the sake that it should benefit us. But if it happens to be advice which is beneficial for ourselves and others, that's great. But the main thing is, if someone comes to you for advice, think about it. And don't be so quick to respond. And also there's a prayer you can make in that moment. Think, God, help me, help this person with whatever advice he or she is seeking. And I think that one can walk away from that experience of giving advice when asked, that at least they're trying. And none of us are going to try to put ourselves as the advisors, but as someone who was put in a situation, a certain time, space, and soulful experience that we could help. With that being said, this program, again, I just want to clarify that, you know, Dennis, Ron, and I have our own distinct viewpoints, and we allow ourselves to agree and disagree, but we don't really emphasize our disagreements as much as we want to give out three perspectives for you, so you blessed listeners can take in what you like and use it to empower yourself to do your own research into the very purpose of why we're doing this show. I mean, I didn't even mention the 7 Noahid Commandments, but it's for a given that we'll just say today that we encourage people to do their research on it, the 7 Noahid Commandments. And that's what we call it Soul Class, which is an acronym for 7 oldest universal laws. But we're not going to delineate them today. Instead, we're going to ask Dennis to please take us to the next segment of the show and pull out Moses Maimonides, Physician, Scientist, and Philosopher, edited by Dr. Fred Rosner and Dr. Samuel S. Kotek.
Page 56, Don.
Yes, sir, I'm there.
Physician of the Soul. From Maimonides' letters and medical writings, there emerges a powerful composite picture of a physician who treats his patients with care and gentleness, a true dispassionate concern that comes from his total subordination of self in the quest for knowledge of God. The manner in which he addresses the vizier al-Malik al-Fidal, in both in the Regimen of Health and the treatise on the causes of symptoms, is not that of a physician who is concerned with his own importance in the court of the ruler of his land. Maimonides' deep caring for his patients is clearly evident in these two medical treatises. Despite the vizier's dissolute lifestyle, which was anti-ethical of everything Maimonides believed in addition to providing all the prescriptions for diet, exercises, syrups, and electuaries for the vizier's depression, anxiety, and constipation in great detail, Maimonides provides the guidance for his ethical growth in an effort to help him achieve some degree of moderation and inner balance. Whoa. He generally condemns the vizier's overindulgence and focuses on the need to achieve peace of mind by efforts of restraint and limiting extremes of emotion. He informs the vizier that this may be accomplished by those who have learned and have studied philosophical virtues and moral admonitions of the religious law and the chastisements. They acquire strength of mind, and they are truly strong. Maimonides is available to lovingly but firmly educate the vizier. And here is a direct quote. How many times has a rich man been impoverished and a king lost his kingdom? And this occurrence became the cause of improvement of his body and the perfection of his soul with virtuous characteristics and the prolongation of his days, bringing him closer to the Lord, his Creator, and his cleavage to him by serving him. This is the ultimate and eternal good. The ending two sentences are, our senses that Maimonides would have treated a beggar with the same gentle care as well as a firm but loving prescribed advice, it is Maimonides himself who exemplifies the fourth and the highest form of perfection.
Beautiful. Dennis, this, I'm joyous in your reading of this because I think there's something we all, blessed souls, can internalize, even though we're not a physician. But because there are characteristics of a physician that Maimonides exemplified that we can hopefully internalize in tiny bit-by-bit efforts, day-by-day efforts. There will be trial and error in our efforts. Rather than a doctor who treats his patients with care and gentleness, to reconsider the sagacity, the wisdom of interacting with our friends with care and gentleness, which is the attributes of the ideal physician, and also to try to emulate again on our own levels. No one's going to encourage anyone to come to a level they're not at, including myself, before all other people. So try to contemplate on how we can ultimately reach some sort of total subordination of oneself for the quest of the knowledge of God. And also when we deal with individuals who are above us, parallel to us, or perhaps maybe a little lower than us, and not to overly judge anyone or to judge anyone, but we understand there are people who are involved in activities that are negative, and yet we might find ourselves rubbing elbows with these individuals, to gently condemn, but in a way of educating them, as I was once told by a very, very wise and well-seasoned social worker, you can say anything you want to anyone at any time, but it's all in the presentation. So you see that Maimonides Rambam was able to lovingly and firmly educate the vizier, I don't know how to pronounce this word correctly, talking about the cycle of life, how a rich man can become poor and a king can lose his kingdom, but yet it's ultimately for their improvement. Now, we do not wish upon any rich person to lose their wealth or some leader of state to suddenly lose their seat of power, unless they're, you know, in the Hitlerian, Stalin, Mao Zedong mode. However, what we do encourage them is through using our means of human supplication of one human soul to another, empowered by the divine image, to encourage them to seek out that which is ultimately good for the person in the relation to the Creator, and being they are people of influence, to hopefully pray for and to supplicate them with gentle words which have very strong wisdom embedded in them, that the ultimate internal good will be for this person of influence to try to better himself and better society. And to conclude with what Dennis was talking about, the beggar treated gently is someone who has a very deep relationship with the Most High, because someone who is a beggar can see probably more accurately, more acutely than, say, those of us who are working or those whose needs are, if not taken care of in a very bountiful way, in a way that we can survive from paycheck to paycheck. And the beggar's tears, if mistreated, register very high in the kingdom of the Most High. And we see that because Maimonides would have, as this book asserts, and his own diaries that testify that he sought to treat anyone who was in need of treatment, physical sickness, intellectual or emotional, soulful sickness. Rambam was a man ready to help anyone. And may we go in the ways of Rambam or any other people who have since followed in his ways, whether they be Jew or Noahide. We'll start with Ron. Ron, any take on my look on it, and then we'll go to Dennis.
I've been recently reading the 8 chapters. It's in the book by Rambam called Shmone Perikim.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways in which he constantly advises us to go in is the way of equanimity, balance.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that once we hit a certain extreme, we oftentimes have to go in the opposite extreme to bring ourselves back to some kind of a balance. I myself find that out exercising sometimes too much, then I have to rest a lot more than I did before to just recuperate from that. So I feel that with everything, if we approach life with a certain type of balance where we can approach things in a... I suffer from a lack of words to explain what I want to say here. We can approach life in kind of an even view. We can more or less keep ourselves... I'm sorry, I can't bring this out in words. Sorry.
Okay. Well, let's have Dennis reflect back on what I said, and then if you have anything more to add, great. If not, we'll move on to the next section. Dennis?
Two main points. One is that we should remind people that Maimonides dealt with the upper echelons of the Arab world during the day, but at night he practiced his medicine just as well with the poor people who couldn't pay him at night. So here was a practitioner of humility and charity and everything rolled into what you'd expect of a good person. But he was practicing this. The other part, Don, was that the prior discussion to reading of Maimonides, we were talking about giving advice and people asking for it. Well, Maimonides also was in that same type of predicament of people asking him for advice. So what I believe is that most people, when they want advice, they want objective advice. They don't care too much about your own personal opinions, but they want to know what is your take on this subject or that subject and how should they react. So to me, the best way to do it is to do it objectively so that you can point out what they shouldn't or what they should do and leave it up to them to make a choice or supply the subjectivity to it. So people don't mind asking for advice as long as they don't feel like you're shoving something down their throat or you're trying to indoctrinate them. In other words, it's open help. And this is the stuff that people accept and believe in.
True, beautiful. Ron, do you want to add anything, or we'll move on to the next section?
Now, the reason for my my stall, if I can say that, a few minutes ago, was because yesterday I was reading the commentary on the Book of Job on Torah.org, and he was a person who lost all his wealth and all his possessions and became a poor person. And one of the reasons were was because on Rosh Hashanah he was actually not denounced, but he was praised by God for being a righteous and a praiseworthy person. And at that point in time, the accuser, the name Satan, he said that maybe Job is only praiseworthy and so righteous because you protect him and all his wealth. Maybe if you subject him to a kind of a reversal of fortune and ill health, maybe he won't be so righteous. And
mm-hmm.
as a result, the entire episode of Job ensued. So when you mentioned Dennis mentioned for us in the Rambam that sometimes wealthy people lose their wealth and the king loses kingdom, and we see eventually that it leads towards a detriment of person. That is exactly what happened in the Book of Job, because Job, in his state of poverty, actually denied divine providence,
mm-hmm.
because he felt he was a righteous person, and there was really no reason he could see why he had to endure such a suffering. But at the end, we see that Job regained his wealth, and he And his entire life was changed because of that episode that he had to endure. So,
the book of Job, I want to mention to anyone listening out there, in terms of a personal story of any biblical or Tanakh character, the most chapters of any person in the entire five books of Moses or the teachings of the prophets, the teachings of the holy writings like Psalms or Proverbs or Ecclesiastes or Lamentations or the stories of Purim, the most chapters of any character in all of the Tanakh is about the righteous Job, the righteous Eve, who was a son of Noah. So anyone who wants to say that, I just want to, as a lead into our next section, the teachings of Rabbi Nachman on how to internalize the Torah, one of the 48 ways of acquiring the Torah, anyone wants to say that the Torah is just a ethnocentric Judaic way of looking upon the world, we say no. Yes, there is a Judaic aspect of it because to me as a Jew or to the nation of Israel, we are Jews because we believe in one Creator who is very, very much concerned about the nature of the human condition, whether it be Jew or one of the blessed nations of the earth. And the instructions, what we learned out from the book of Job, applies to all of us, no matter who we are. That being said, I want to move on to the next section, which is really fits in like a hand fits into a glove, like a ball hitting a bat, like a Jeremy Lin jump shot being made when they're not playing the Miami Heat. And that's Ohev et HaTochochos. This is a person should love instruction, which can also be understood as rebuke. Now, speaking of rebuke, I was given instruction. I wouldn't call it rebuke by Dennis last week, that I have to be a little more careful how I deliver Rabbi Nachman's teachings. First, I want to correct myself from last week because it's a very important principle in Torah that when one makes a mistake, one should correct oneself. And since I made my mistake publicly, I want to correct myself publicly. Well, last week's Torah virtue or a way of internalizing the Torah according to the teachings of Rabbi Nachman is Ohev et HaMasharim. I said to love the straight way. I think in Dennis said the direct way. Well, one other, I saw an English translation that it means to love the judgments, which are straight and direct pathways in redirecting oneself's actions. So that's just a correction of my mistake last week. But certainly here now, as Rabbi Nachman wants us to know, and again, in each part of these elucidations and the 48 ways of acquiring the Torah, that one should accept instruction / rebuke, meaning reproof, being corrected of one's mistakes. And he said this is something that a person not only should accept the tochacha, the rebuke or the instruction, one should love it. Now, I want to tell you, gentlemen, before we started the show, we have a cat, Poochie, who is a beautiful cat. We've had him about 7 months now. And before the show, my landlady called and said, your cat is crying. I said to her, and I didn't really accept it, and I'm, I said, well, cats are known to cry. She said, well, your cat is in the hallway, which means he's one step of stepping out of our apartment and being lost to us. And there are many wild stray cats in our neighborhood, and he wouldn't last too long in the wild. So I said, uh-oh, and I thanked her, and then I apologized, and I accepted it because if it would have been my responsibility, if I had caused our cat to get lost and wander in the street and get mauled or killed, how much more so I would have received rebuke and correction from the members of my family, especially my children and my wife. So, you see, I accepted it on one level to save myself from accepting it at the next level, which probably would have been more severe. Now, one of the things that Rabbi Nachman wants us to know is, aside from the fact that we should be able to receive correction, even if it comes in the form of rebuke, he says it's forbidden that a person should gore another person with their knowledge. And that even if a person is very sharp in their teachings, and he's called in Yiddish a bezer lamdan, meaning I guess that means a sharp lamdan. But if a person uses his sharpness to stab everyone who encounters him, and he wants to show that the law, the righteousness is with him and not with anyone else, And if someone comes to rebuke him or her, but he's not interested in receiving that type of rebuke, that this person eventually will see that his words are not going to be accepted readily. And therefore, no one can say that if a person, even if he's acquired a great knowledge, is beyond reproach, because we see the great ones in the history of time as written in the Torah, in the five books of Moses. Even Moshe himself was rebuked by the Almighty. King David was rebuked. Samuel the prophet was rebuked. Isaiah. All the great ones at some point had to receive correction from none other than the Most High. So, you know, unfortunately, we're not at the level of prophets, but when people do have a difference in their opinions in how to perceive a teaching from the scriptures or the oral traditions, or in a matter of secular matters or a business dealing, if they cannot at the end come to some sort of mediation, some sort of accord which will lead to a strengthening of the bonding between party A and party B, then somewhere along the line, on either side of the line of disagreement, someone did not want to get correction. And I think that, if I remember correctly, I'm just trying to pull out of my long-term memory, one time that the Lubavitch Rebbe wrote to someone who was wrote to him about trying to resolve an argument over some issue, and the Rebbe mentioned to him, if there is a disagreement between two parties, that doesn't mean that one side is 100% right and the other side is 100% wrong. So there's something going on in the communication process between two or more human beings where a difference arises, where both sides have to do a great self-introspective look inside themselves to see, why have we come to this point? And why have we come to this point? Well, to get more feedback from Dennis and Ron. So Dennis, your reflections on my attempts to try to improve my presentation, Rabbi Nachman's, one of the ways to receive the Torah and internalize it by accepting reproof, correction, or as the world would call it, rebuke.
Well, you mentioned in the beginning of the program, first couple of minutes, about how to be simple or keep it simple. Simple and direct works because people find that easier to accept. If you're trying to give advice, if you're trying to explain something, and let's say you're overeducated or you know too much about it, you must still have some humility inside that reminds you to put your ego in your back pocket. If people think you're expressing arrogance through your ego, or they even smell or hint of it, they're very suspicious and they throw up a defensive network that will reject almost everything you say. So you can mess up by outsmarting yourself. If you are smart, you're educated, and you know a lot of things, you must contain your ego so that you can talk on the level of understanding to all peoples.
Beautiful. Ron, your take on these matters?
For me, I found that one of the ways that always seems to get through to other people is if you share with them some sort of shortcoming, kind of similar to theirs, then they feel as if basically you're on the same level and you're not just someone giving over instructions or rebuke, but you're a colleague who have faltered in a similar path. And when they recognize this, they sense the sincerity because you realize that you've also faltered as they have, and you're not just menting out instruction or rebuke, but you're just sharing what you've used to better yourself, and they're many times most likely to accept that. And it comes more as if you're sharing with a friend as opposed to giving over rebuke or instruction.
Beautiful. Very nice. Okay, so with that being said, let's now go to our next section. As we move right along, let's move along. Let's see where we're holding on the time. We have about 50 minutes to go. So you know what? I'll tell you what, gentlemen. We're going to take a musical break. Just want to refresh myself in a certain area of what we want to present In our next section on compassion towards humanity in the Jewish tradition, and of course the path of the Russian Gentile by Rabbi Rogalsky and Rabbi Klorfin. This is called Endless Gratitude, which I think, again, is a segue which fits like a glove by Rabbi Lazer Brody from his album Calming Waters, which was released last year. So hoping these calming waters will have a calming effect. Water is likened to wisdom. Wisdom is known to have a calming effect on the human condition when there's a profundity. And I do like this music because it is profound music, and it has the effect of calming waters, at least on myself. Enjoy, everyone, for the next 3 or 4 minutes. Take care. Hold on, please. Gentlemen and blessed souls out there, that was Tranquil Waters by Rabbi Lazer Brody. I personally like his music. I've seen the man speak, Rob, and he's a wonderful speaker. I think he's a wonderful human being. He's a work in progress like the rest of us, and since he's several years older than me, I like seeing someone who's a little older than me growing, and I think that's an important part of the process to me of personal growth is watching people older than me grow in their experiences and teachings and lessons in life and sharing with the rest of us. So we get encouragement as younger people that we should try to grow. Dennis, any thoughts on that matter, how we can get encouragement watching people older than ourselves still seek to grow as human beings? Not, and unfortunately, too many people just stop once they leave the educational system and thinking they're a finished product.
Well, I'd like to get quickly back to an idea that you spoke of about 10, 15 minutes ago, Don. And that was the Bible, the Tanakh. You said that it's not just a Jewish thing or a Hebrew type of thing. You're quite correct. What it is, it's a book or a source for humans regarding humanity and their life. In those writings, there's something for everybody in there. And it behooves everybody to find out what's in there so they can enhance their lives. All right. That being said, the question you just asked me, could you repeat that again, Don?
Yeah, Dennis, how do you feel when you see someone older than yourself continue to seek growth as a human being? And not just, unfortunately, we've seen too many people in our lifetimes who finish high school, college, even graduate school, maybe even they got a PhD, and look at themselves and project themselves as a finished piece of work as a human being. And how you feel empowered if you see someone older than yourself continue to grow with their life experiences and serve as a role model for you to grow further as a human being.
Well, growth is a funny thing to humans because sometimes it can be an endless thing. In other words, you may take a lifetime and still not know everything you want to know, but it's inherent in every human being that at some point in time, at some point in your life, you're going to use what you have learned. You must use it. To keep saying you're going to keep learning it can be an excuse sometimes. But you must practice what you believe. You must do what you've been educated for. And you must say that I'm going to use whatever talent I have. Because that's what makes us. That's what makes each person different. So it's your conscience. It's your divine intellect all working together. And you must use with what you have. Now, it's nice to hear somebody who's still learning, but at the same time, you would say, gee whiz, they've been at it too long. Haven't they learned enough to do something? They keep saying that they're going to go in for more education. It's nice. But at some point in time, you must do with what you have.
Beautiful. Ron, how do you feel when you see someone older than yourself growing? And I want to let's make the question with another layer or another texture. How do you feel when you see someone growing in their life experience as someone that's older than you and putting it into practical action, what they're gaining from their life learning experiences?
I look at it from the perspective of constant development, because When you see a person develop, it's not only in learning, but it's also in action, behavior. It's a more encompassing type of growth in terms of comprehensive development, and it just gives you hope as a younger person that, you know, I'm not just suddenly going to hit a dead end in my life where I'm just stagnated, because it seems to be a natural process in life. I work right now with a 95-year-old man who started our company, and he is as enthusiastic and constantly willing to learn. Recently, I saw him sitting at the computer, and he still uses his old typewriter machine, but nevertheless, he's still interested in understanding how a computer actually works, and not only to learn, but actually to use it. So that is, you know, for me, it was more or less a lot of encouragement to see that, you know, you just don't shut down past a certain age and, you know, you become stagnant. So, to me, it's encouragement.
Beautiful, beautiful. I also want to acknowledge that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Nachman Schneerson, 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe, on his 80th birthday, stood for hours. I think it was in front of 770, which is the central congregation of the Lubavitch Hasidic movement, and gave out this book called Tanya, which I just want to mention. I know Ron's mentioned it on various occasions. He gave out a book which is designed to sensitize the human heart condition to extricate itself from a type of spiritual shell, just like the shell, that hard, hairy coconut shell, is concealing that wonderful coconut milk and that wonderful coconut meat within it. And the teachings of the Tanya were designed to help us crack the shell, that coconut shell within our own hearts, so to speak, to do as much as we can until we have the prophetic actualization of the circumcision of the heart, which will take place with every human being. That the Rebbe talked about this idea that from the Pirkei Avos, the teachings of our sages, that at the age of 80, a person reaches might. And the Rebbe, I believe, in that talk, perhaps in the talks that preceded that day on his birthday where he gave out the Tanyas, and the days afterwards, that the idea that a person is getting older actually makes that person more valuable to society. And to get into this idea of retirement is really something which is antithetical to a Torah perspective. Now, of course, a person can stop working if they've accumulated a certain amount of wealth, and we wish everyone to be wealthy and healthy and have the health to use their wealth properly. But that a person has other endeavors after they, quote-unquote, retire from their work, because a person, as they get older, they've acquired many life wisdoms, and perhaps they've acquired Torah wisdom, or they've acquired secular wisdom, scientific wisdom, and they can use it and become advisors to society. I mean, we're talking about, of course, an idealistic view of society. But on the other hand, when we look at societies which disrespect their elderly, ultimately that society will be revealed to be one who disrespects the younger generation and the new generation. So if there's disrespect for the elderly generation, there's disrespect for the younger or the new generation, the ones in between will probably in the end as well not get too much respect, and it becomes a kind of like a chaotic, you know, me-first society, which unfortunately sometimes can be observed in any society on this planet Earth. But the idea is that a person gets older, they become more valuable. And I want to share with you, gentlemen, and bless those out there, some valuable teachings from Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish tradition. That this is a teaching, again, coming from Rabbi Nassen Sternhartz, from a gathering of Jewish law based on the Talmudic tractate of Kedushin, which is the oral Torah traditions of Israel, how a Jewish couple gets married. He says the following, Rabbi Steinhardt, which is taken again, I'm taking this translation from Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish tradition of like David Sears, that it is necessary to reveal to all of humanity, from the greatest to the humblest individual, that there is a creator. Therefore, the Torah was given in written form. By writing, which is a physical act, the light of this perception, faith of God, is drawn into the physical world, because now these teachings about the creator has been put down on physical paper. Thus, the ultimate purpose of creation is going to be fulfilled, that all people should apprehend God's oneness. Dennis, any take on that teaching?
Well, God's oneness is not in dispute. It is a divine thing, and we must recognize that. It's a level above humanity, and we're all underneath that umbrella. And we must act accordingly, and treat our fellow men as though they're underneath the same umbrella.
True. Ron, your take on the idea that writing down these teachings is allowing for faith and knowledge of the Creator to be drawn more into this physical world?
I just want to pick up on what Dennis has said, that, you know, knowledge of God is divine. Dennis, that's what you said before, that God is divine, and...
Yes.
Right. I also wanted to add to that his the knowledge he gave us through the Torah is also divine. It's not just a written historical document. And many times it's viewed in that fashion. And Don, I wanted to just get back a little bit to what you said previously about treating the old with disdain. We tend to treat people, elderly people, as old creations that as something that was created by man, because most of our creations become old and extinct, and if not constantly upgraded, it's basically just a hunk of metal. But people, on the other hand, we are created by the Creator. We are created by that, the divine. As a result, we bear that divinity within us, so we don't just become old and extinct. And that's why we should be treated with that, you know, the elderly should be treated with that same type of respect and regard.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my take on this.
Okay. I'd like to learn from one. Yes,
Don,
yes, sir.
I happen to be one of those old people. And
well, you're young at heart, man.
Well, let me just tell you, I've known a lot of people over a period of time. And even though I love them, a lot of them earlier in their life locked into certain ideas, and they're not open-minded anymore, but they proceed to keep repeating what they learned years ago over and over and over. And I'm not saying it's bad, but what I am saying is a lot of them are not still learning because their mind is not open anymore. So we have people who maybe do the physical things, cannot really rethink or reanalyze anything because they have it memorized by now. So we have to be careful that not all old people have wisdom. We hope that they mean well, God bless them, and we hope that they're doing right. But just because they've acquired age doesn't make them any different than anybody else. It's those people who openly are willing to share what they have learned and hope that it falls on ears. And like you said in verse 8, there was a garden. Well, I treat everybody's mind as a little garden, and we're trying to help them out.
Beautiful, beautiful. So I'd like to go to one more teaching from the Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition, then we'll move on to the Path of Rashi Gentile. And this is a teaching from, again, the Lubavitcher Rebbe from, I guess this would have been from 29 years ago. And he says the following. He taught the following. The future redemption will apply not only to Israel, but to the whole world as well. As we say in the Eleno prayer. Now, the Eleno prayer is the prayer where Jewish people, we conclude one of our three daily prayers. It was a prayer that was written by Joshua, Yahushua ben Nun, who took over from Moses to lead when he led the 12 tribes of Israel into the land of Canaan, what became also known as the land of Israel until this day. That, as we say in the Eleno prayer, quote, to perfect the world under the sovereignty of God, unquote. In preparation for this redemption, therefore, action needs to be taken so the world at large will be ready for such a state. This is to be achieved through the efforts of the Jewish people as we try to influence the nations of the world to conduct themselves in the spirit of the verse which states that God, quote, formed the world in order that it be settled, unquote, and that was a prophetic teaching from Isaiah 45:18, in a civilized manner for the observance of the seven universal Noahide commandments. Now, notice, gentlemen, there was no mention of some sort of supernatural revelation, nothing about, you know, angelic intervention, but rather there needs to be action taken that the world at large, this physical world, should be ready for such a time, a joyous time as the universal redemption will be speedily in our days. And again, this is the crux, this is the essence of what we're trying to share with other people, with our hearts in a state of joy and in a state of contrition if we're not making enough effort, that we have to take action. And it doesn't mean that we're going to burn down buildings, we're going to tear down mountains. It means day-to-day living, which hopefully is a little bit elevated a little bit more today than it was yesterday. That spring in your walking out into the street or greeting your neighbor or helping someone should be with a little bit more, hopefully, positive energy. So, you know, we are beings of we have electric current running through us, aside from our bones and our blood and our soul and our veins and our arteries and our nervous system. We have energy. And preparing the world for the redemption requires that we have to use our energy in the right way. So let's, Ron, your take on the Rebbe's instruction that we have to, action is a means of preparing the world for redemption.
I mean, I don't think there's much, there's very little to say on this, because we all know that without action, nothing happens at all. And action also means, to some people, it would mean the actual building. Some people, action comes in the form of speech. And on even a higher level, action comes even in thought. Because we all know that what we think eventually translates into action. So we have to start working from whatever level that we are at this point in time, but we must start. And I humbly suggest, I mean, first and foremost to myself, is that I first start by acquiring that which precedes them all, which is thought. And acquiring a certain knowledge influences the thought process, and in turn influences the way I speak, the way I, and ultimately the way I behave in action. So, you know, we have to work on the three processes, the thought process that we have ultimately, and hopefully it translates into a proper way of speaking and then a proper way of acting. So, from my perspective.
Okay. Dennis, your take on these matters?
The only action that humans can take is to live a better life. And you must do this because you have to question yourself. Am I doing the best? Can I do better? If you're not doing better, then maybe you're giving up. But why give up? If you're looking forward for the hope of tomorrow, you must prepare for the future. But the future is depending on what you're doing now. So the actions you're doing now will affect your future. And can you do better? We all know what right and wrong is, but are you really emphasizing the right or the correct things to do? And are you staying away from the other things? Not easy sometimes, but a lot of humans will say, why do I have to prepare? I'm happy what I'm doing now. But the question is, are you really happy in relation to the future and where you think you're going to be going? So we must answer that question again. Can we do better?
Well, I you know what, Dennis, and you know what? That is a question that is used frequently in the treatment of people with some sort of disability, where there's something called a pre-contemplative state, meaning a person is stuck, for instance, we'll give an example, a person is stuck within the addiction of cigarette smoking, or say alcohol, where they cannot see themselves outside of their self-imposed terrarium or aquarium or intellectual, emotional, spiritual jail cell of a life to the, you know, that excludes the usage of cigarettes or, you know, alcohol. So therefore, those of us who are involved in helping such individuals, we try to bring them to a state where they, not just us, will come to the question. I mean, we can impose the question, but it's more effective when the person who needs to be freed from some sort of addiction or some sort of obsessive compulsive disorder or some sort of paranoid thought process, when they come to ask themselves, can I do better than this? And, you know, many times people will say, yes, they can do better than where they are. But then there's the troubling event within a person's consciousness where they feel soothed by remaining imprisoned within their addiction to alcohol, drugs, or smoking, or within their obsessive compulsive behaviors or paranoid thoughts because the unknown scares them. Yet they realize they can do better. And so all we can do is hopefully frame the situation at hand and deliver it to them hopefully in a peaceful and pleasant way, in a loving, caring way, as we talked about before. It was the style of the Rambam, which we try to emulate, where they will formulate the question to themselves. And they won't have to say it, they don't have to parrot what we're saying, but they will formulate the question, they will respond, yes, I can do better, and then we can help them take those little baby steps. What is that saying? A journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. Well, you know what? To all levels of self-improvement, it all starts with a single step. Well, helping other people ask themselves, can they do better? Dennis, your take on my feedback.
Well, you're bringing up Job again. Because Job is an example that was put in the Bible for all humans to understand. And feeling sorry for yourself, feeling down about yourself, is a waste of time. You accomplish nothing. You must have firm resolve that you can do better, that you can improve. And that is an addiction in and of itself that will serve you better than cigarettes, alcohol, or any other thing that's called those so-called addictions, because you're only fooling yourself. If you don't get the high from yourself, do you really think something external is going to make you feel better? Momentarily, you're only kidding yourself. But we can always do better.
Beautiful. Ron, your take on these matters?
Okay. Let me put this together, try to put this together as best as I can. I think when people predicate their life goal on acquisitions of physical, on the material things, when they've acquired it, they feel as if it's basically the end is close to the end, because actually not acquired, but in the pursuit of acquiring it, after a while we feel like overstimulated by this, and we feel as if there's nothing in front, nothing beyond this. We get suffocated by our own pursuit of physicality. And there's no fresh insight of anything beyond that. As a result, I think people stop trying and stop. Life becomes stale. And I'm saying this because when I lived in South America, we were I wouldn't say deprived, but we didn't have access to many physical, actually even necessities. We didn't have access to that because we had an embargo against the country after we became communist. Mm-hmm. So we were totally cut off from the entire, from technology, from the West, from everything, basically. And everyone there, we looked forward to a life when we come to America and what it had to offer. Being 24 years living here, without pursuing wisdom, honestly speaking, there's nothing more to pursue. What else will you get? You have a house, you have a car, you have a good job, you have money. What else? There's nothing else. And if we just predicate our whole life's mission on acquisitions, after a while, when we've acquired certain amount of things, there's nothing left. And then the boredom and a kind of a depressed feeling sets in. So we must find what to aspire to become better to begin with. And that's where I think this acquisition of knowledge of the Creator and the reason and mission why we're here, it transcends this physical desires that we have and goals that we set for ourselves. And there is where we can actually wake up and be refreshed and start again and have this whole new enthusiasm and, as you say, that extra spring in your step. It only can come from a fresh new outlook, because if we continue in the same, just going to work every day, acquiring a paycheck and coming home, after a while it becomes stale and there's nothing to aspire to any longer. So
beautiful.
Don?
Yes.
I'd like to offer up a couple of words of wisdom here.
Well, we're willing to listen, because I know you're a person that grows as you grow older in your knowledge and wisdom and understanding, and I faithfully am ready and willing to accept and then allow you to share what you have to share with the rest of the world.
Life
don't
is boring.
You're only sharing with... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Life is boring without God.
Well said.
I would like to add that there is no life without him, and no life is certainly much more boring than life with him, because life with him is what makes life life. I mean, being alive, being energized, to me, is not boring. It's what I'm living for, to be constantly energized. Okay, gentlemen, let's move on to the next section, The Path of Rise Agenda by Rabbis Chaim Klorfin and Rabbi Yaakov Legalski. And we're going to pick up on page 29 in the section on returning to God, returning to the Most High. Repentance, teshuvah, atones for all sins. Even if one is evil all of the days of his life and returns to God on the last of his days, none of his wickedness is mentioned to him in the divine judgment. And I think, let me just see here, that's footnote 11. Yes, that's the source of that are coming from the teachings of Rambam. And that you would find in the chapter 2, law 2. I think that would be in the laws of repentance by Rambam. So in the next section, next paragraph, so what is complete repentance? What is complete tshuva? If, after having confessed, it occurs to the person to repeat the transgression done in the past, and if the opportunity to do so does arise, and he or she resists and refrains from doing it solely because of his act of wanting to return to God, and not because of his fear of anyone, say a policeman, for instance, and not because he is too weak physically, can no longer do it, then he has achieved complete repentance. For example, if a man had a relationship which is forbidden with a woman, and then he came to repent and confessed, and after a time, if it happens that he finds himself alone with her again, and now he resists and does not transgress, then we can say of this person, according again to the teachings of Rambam, that this person has be considered to be a person who has done complete repentance. We'll just read one more paragraph, then we'll go to Ron and Dennis, Dennis and Ron. If a person returns to God, repenting of his or her transgressions only in their old age, at a time of life when he or she is no longer able to repeat the transgressions of the past, although this is not the highest form of repentance, it does help the person, and the person is considered to be a true penitent who has returned to God. And again, this is the ruling of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimonides Rambam. Dennis, any thoughts on these matters?
Yes, the river of forgiveness from God is endless. That is, it's a bottomless source. It just keeps coming. But it's inherent to each human to be a part of that. You want to reject his forgiveness, well, then you are committed to the other side. That's your business. You have your free will. God is willing to forgive you for almost anything. Why? Because he's almighty and he can do that. So therefore, you must figure out in your heart, in your mind, are you with him and are you willing to partake in some of his forgiveness?
Beautiful. Ron, your take on these teachings or anything you want to amplify that we just read?
I just wanted to mention that, and this is coming from my experience, that once you embark on the process of repentance, returning to God, what happens is that you start developing a connection. And many of the things that you've done prior to this time, once you start asking for forgiveness and you're really sincere, a lot of things that you've done did in the past that, you know, maybe you were ignorant of whether it was right or wrong, maybe you had doubts, but nevertheless you did them, they come back to you. They come back to your thoughts, they come back to your mind. And what you do then is that you start asking for forgiveness for things you did a long time ago, which you probably didn't even consider the point in time it was a violation of God's will, or not, you know. But it, you have a flow. It basically, like you see your life starts passing before you, and you start seeing things that weren't that you've done that were not acceptable, and maybe people that you've hurt. And one of the things about the forgiveness process is that it's not only between yourself and the Creator, but it's between you and man like yourself, your fellow man. And when you start asking God for forgiveness, and certain episodes may arise where you probably hurt someone else besides, you know, yourself in connection with the Creator, you're actually obligated to ask that person also to forgive you. Because it's a very comprehensive process. It's not just, you know, okay, I hurt my mother's feelings, but you know what, I'm going to ask God to forgive me and everything is good. You actually have to go over to her and ask her for forgiveness. And once you start that, you start feeling like this huge burden starts to just melt away from your shoulders. And also, you have to make this kind of a declaration for the future. Because all this is part of this repentance process, where you have to make certain declarations that you're not going to engage in this, at least intentionally, any longer. And it's just an ongoing process where you start feeling so like relieved and enlightened that it's something that I honestly suggest everyone should try, because you really feel a difference.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
Yes, once you start understanding how easy it is to be forgiven and participate in the process, out comes the human laundry list of all other things that you're reminded that you may have done wrong or hurt somebody or sinned in the past. So what happens is you start, as Ron said, you start unloading some of these things you've been carrying around.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And the truth is, it's only because we acknowledge that God, the Almighty Creator, is unlimited, that He is the capacity. I mean, if you think about all the billion, I mean, we have, what, close to 7 billion people today? I mean, think of all the billions and billions of people that have lived throughout human history. Yet the Most High knew there would be such a large amount of people, and yet there's no sign, there's no clear indication at all, at least from observable human experience, anyone has testified, that He has run out of patience. In fact, He is the one that Moses testified to in the prophetic teachings, that He is long in anger, and He is willing to how should we say it, I don't want to say long-suffering, but He's able to bear our lackings. And the very fact that He's able to bear our lackings certainly is testimonial, ample, potent testimonial, that He is certainly well-equipped to deal with our lackings, to allow us to deal with our own lackings, even though we have sometimes a more acute perception of it in the terms of our own human experience, because the Most High doesn't have to experience our experience. He wants us to experience ourselves, our perceptions of what we have to fix. And from the teachings that we have in the oral tradition, it gives Him great pleasure that we recognize our lackings, not to become sour and dour and downtrodden, but to rejoice and realize, hey, one more proof that we're finite, we make mistakes, and we have the chance now to reconnect in the strongest possible way. It might have came in an unfortunate way through our misdoings, but now we have a chance to make correction. And, you know, all of us have taken tests in school and we've had our papers corrected. And then the next time, because we learn from our corrections, again, loving instruction, loving reproach, or rebuke, whatever you want to call it, we became better students. So with that being said, gentlemen, let's now go. We have about 10 minutes to go. We have a verse in Genesis chapter 2, verse 8, which is so wondrous, so, again, it's joyous to me because, you know, the last several weeks we were, you know, engaging in meditations of gratitude to the Most High for taking us out of the dust and breathing a living soul. So the Bechen, as we said in Hebrew, the practical outcome is that since we were created, there was some type, place we had to live. So it's described as the following. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 8, God planted a garden in Eden to the east, and there he placed man that he had formed. So according to the oral Torah instruction, the Torah wants us to inform us that the Most High planted a delightful place in the east. Now, we're not going to go into the discussion, although Dennis and Ron, you're certainly welcome to give your viewpoint of where that part of the east of the world it was. But the important point is when we talk about this garden, the garden was planted in a place called Eden, or Eden, as we say in English, Eden in Hebrew. Now, the word Eden in Hebrew also means delight. Now, we can understand that to be this delightful place was a place for the Most High to delight in the workings of man, and man to delight in the fact that he was blessed to be raised up from the dust and have a living soul believed into him, and now have a most wondrous of environment to live in, a garden which was meant to be a garden of delight. Now, as well, that explicit commandment were given, according to the oral Torah tradition, that such particular types of trees would grow in this Garden of Eden, the Gan Eden, to always have foliage and be filled with fruit. And these trees will never grow old, nor they would require any attention like ordinary trees. Now, why should we be told this, and what does this relate to the placing of man? Well, we know that things are planted in the earth and things are taken out of the earth. We learned in the previous verse that we were gathered from the dust. The dust is something which can be on top of the earth, planted in the earth. But when the Most High places trees, which would be full of foliage and fruit, a place that he can delight in our actions, and we can delight in the fact we were given this experience, we should not be surprised that these trees would never grow old, that they would require any attention like ordinary trees. And the fact of the matter is that we do know that there is a certain type of dating process where people will measure the age of trees and can extrapolate from that the age of the earth. So I'm not, actually, as I look at these teachings, and we're going to go back to these teachings next week as well, because there's a lot of teachings to be extracted from the oral Torah on these teachings, on this verse, chapter 2, verse 8. I want to go around the table, gentlemen, and get your viewpoints. I mean, I don't know, Dennis, if you've been exposed to these type of teachings. Ron, you probably have. But your idea, the idea that Most High, the original environment for man to dwell in was to be a place of causing delight to him and for man to delight in his service to God.
Well, I would take the word garden to mean the earth. But the garden is the concept of where things can grow and multiply. So a garden, because the word planting is mentioned in a garden, which makes sense that the world would grow from the earth, okay? And he put the man in the best place he could do where man could grow. Question is, has man grown? Now, as there, we have later in the verse 13 where it says, the whole land of Cush. Today, you'll see that on the map, and it starts with a K, the land of Cush. But that was an area where you would think, how can you fail? If God created this, and this is the place, do your thing, humans.
Ron, your take on this verse.
One of the things I came to realize in this whole this chapter here is that man at this point in time has not done anything to deserve this type of delight. Didn't do anything at all. God created the garden and placed him in it. Prior to that, man didn't do anything to deserve this type of good. So we see that God is loving, he's kind, and he only wants what's best for us. Our job is to keep that in mind throughout all of life and realize that God's intention for us is that we should have delight. We should be in a delightful place, whether it's in our homes, but it's in our own minds, because this is God's original intent for us, and we're the ones that get in the way of that 90% of the time.
Mm-hmm. I just want to embellish that with, you know, as an expression of gratitude. There's a Talmudic teaching that actually, when we talk about the Garden of Eden, the Talmud instructs us that the entire world is considered to be 1/60th of this garden in terms of, I'm going to extract out of it exponentially, from an exponential perspective, that in terms of from this, the rest of this world, from this primordial Garden of Eden, we can experience 1/60th of the delights of serving in God. And I'm not going to put any limitation on how much God can delight in our service, but that specific place, which was called Garden or Gan, is 1/60th of a divine place, because there is a spiritual level, as we mentioned before, of Eden or Aden means delight. So what we're talking about here, gentlemen and blessed souls listening out there, is that not everything that we see in this world is the total picture. So the deeper dimension of this teaching is that the Most High planted a garden in Eden to the east, and there he placed man that he had formed, is that if we understand that this was supposed to be a place that was to be eternal, and man was supposed to be part of an eternal plan, which we are, unfortunately there was a fall from grace because of misdoings, that there is a type of infinite potential within the consciousness of human beings to constantly seek new ways to delight in their service in this garden, which is really the whole earth. I do agree with Dennis. It's really ultimately alluding to the dispersion of a consciousness of delighting in serving God and hopefully eliciting delight from him in our service. That when we come to this understanding, I think we look a little bit differently upon this planet Earth as opposed to the way, unfortunately, it's parceled up and chopped up like pieces of meat on a butcher's board, and then saying this is the world in pieces and nations. I mean, we're not saying we should dismantle nationhood or nation states, but rather to understand that there was originally a type of unified, eternal unity within the creation where man was supposed to be ideally delighting in his service and eliciting delights from the Most High, which would be morphologically transferred to us as a way we can understand as living human beings, as his blessings, that this earth would continually be an eternal living experience for human beings. Gentlemen, if you both were welcome to chime in, Dennis and then Ron, and then we're going to conclude with Innocent Child by David Dohm. We start with David Dohm and we'll end with David Dohm with Innocent Child, but first we'll have Dennis give his final statements for this week's program.
You used the word delights, Don. I rather use the word that God expected good things out of humans that were planted in his garden of earth so that his form, his image, would show that the righteous things are going to happen.
Beautiful. Ron?
I think there was a little bit of misdirection. Man was supposed to look up in delight instead of he looked down. He looked the physical and material for the delight instead of looking to the Creator. And we have to remember that he originally is the one, the source of all delight. So we just have to look in the right direction.
Beautiful. And I think we're looking in the right direction, gentlemen, by me, first of all, expressing my gratitude for both of you participating today. We're going to end with Innocent Child by David Dohm, which is really within all of us, and because that's connected to the idea of returning, repenting, and doing it out of state of joy to realize we have a divine image, which is not just taking the football and going off the scrimmage, and it is no dream, your Tzelem Elokim, your divine image. This is Innocent Child by David Dohm to help us get back home to that sense of innocence, which we never lost. Now we have to realize it can be found. Take care, everyone.
Shalom.
Begin again.